A formative period in Maine, from the Civil War through World War I. It's often said that studying history offers us important perspective about our present and our future. Today we'll explore Maine's history, coming out of the Civil War and through the Great War, and what lessons we might learn from the state's evolution during that era. From leaders like Oliver Otis Howard to James Blaine, Maine gained national prominence in those years. The state also began to build up the industries that define our state today, from lumber to tourism to the arts. I'm Cindy Hahn. Join me for a conversation with two historians as we continue our series of programs on Maine history, part of our ongoing coverage of topics relating to Maine's bicentennial. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. What was Maine like in the period between the Civil War and World War I? We'll talk about the people and the movements that made an impact during this time of transition in our state. Today's show is part of our ongoing coverage of topics relating to Maine's bicentennial. Joining me, Libby Bischoff. She's professor of history with the University of Southern Maine, and she's executive director of the Osher Map Library. And Earl Shettleworth, he is Maine's longtime state historian. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you heard stories of family members who were involved in the Great War? What do you want to know about Maine's growing role in our nation during the late 19th and early 20th centuries? Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. And we will get to Maine's history in a moment, but before we discuss that, we have an update on changes to Maine's bicentennial celebration. And joining me on the line now is State Senator Bill Diamond. He's chairman of Maine's Bicentennial Commission. Thanks for calling, Senator.
Oh, you're welcome, Cindy. Nice to talk to you all.
So it's this year, 2020, that marks Maine's bicentennial, but it has turned out to be quite an unexpected year so far. Can you tell us what changes you've made to the plans for bicentennial events?
Yes, I can. Yes, there's 2.5 years of work all ready to go, starting on Statehood Day of March 15th this year. And, of course, COVID hit, and that has now since caused us to make pretty much take the entire package of all the things we had planned, which was Statehood Day, which was the parade in Lewiston Auburn, the State of Maine parade. That was on in May 16th, and then the tall ships, which would take 3 weeks during the summer up and down the coast, and then ended by an expo and the time capsule. All those things are very exciting, but we decided we had to move those into the next year just out of concern of safety for everybody, and we want everyone to enjoy to the maximum all the things and as a result of all the work that's been done. So essentially going to take everything, move it to 2021, and we'll call it 200 plus one.
And so pretty much things will happen at the same time of year that they would have happened this year?
That's correct. We'll start off with the Statehood Day, 1 day difference. We'll do it on Sunday, March 14th, but then the parade in May, as I say, and the other events as planned be pretty close to the exact days that we had them planned this year. But we're excited. It's going to be all the work that's been done. It's going to be bigger and better even. Maybe we have a little more time to add a few things. So
you feel like if it's the 201st birthday, it's equally meaningful?
It may be, and you know what? Beyond that, I think it makes us a little more unique and our celebration a little more unique. So, yes, absolutely. We won't miss a step.
And where can people find out more information about those dates and plans?
They just go right online, Maine 200, and you'll see all of the events that has been planned, and they'll see the new dates and all that goes with that.
Well, thank you for that update and for being resilient in these times. That was Senator Bill Diamond. He heads the Maine Bicentennial Commission. Thank you. And switching over to what the bicentennial is all about, which is Maine history, Earl, we're talking today about sort of what's happening in Maine coming out of the Civil War and what impact the war had on the way of life here in Maine. Is there a way you can sort of paint a picture for what Maine kind of looked like in this period and what was happening with our economy?
Yes. Of course, economy continued to be very traditional, what it had been in the 18th into the 19th century. Lumbering was very important, shipbuilding, fishing, farming. But there were also some new industries. Those include, of course, the result of the Industrial Revolution of the 1840s and 50s, with big factory towns like Saco Biddeford, Lewiston, Auburn, and right after the war, big factories, which were textile producing factories, were built on the Kennebec River in Augusta and in Waterville. Also along the rivers, particularly along the Kennebec and the Penobscot, there was a new big industry of ice cutting. So there was really a lot of activity. And also in the post-Civil War period, you have the emergence of a big papermaking industry, particularly beginning around Topsom in 1868, with that beautiful brick mill that many of us see today when we cross the bridge there between Topsom and Brunswick. And those paper mills then extended into western Maine, particularly into places like Jay and Rumford and Livermore, particularly along the Androscoggin River, became a huge industry by the 1880s and 90s.
So it sounds like it was such a period of activity here. Is there a way to characterize the mood of the state or the people at that time?
Well, I think it was mixed in that, of course, the Civil War had a huge impact on the state. We had contributed about 70,000 troops, over 30 regiments. And of those 70,000 men, about 10 to 11,000 did not return. And then another phenomenon occurred. For those who did return, the 60,000 or so, some of them took stock of their lives and decided that Maine was not the place in which they wished to do their future, and they went west, some for farming, some for lumbering. There's quite a few instances of families who moved from rural Maine into the Midwest and the West. So that was a change. And in fact, it's the one period between 1860 and 1870 that Maine's population does not grow. We actually fall back slightly in our census figures. However, for the most part, there was a good deal of optimism. And there were, in addition to the various economic factors that I've already mentioned, there was a whole new force arriving, both on the Maine coast and inland in the woodland areas, for tourism. Summer colonies, summer hotels, summer cottages, all up and down the coast from York Harbor and Kittery right up to beyond Ellsworth to places like Sorrento and Hancock Point. And in addition, a whole new interest in the western North Woods, particularly the Rangeley area for hunting and fishing, and both hunting and fishing camps, sporting camps, both group ones and also individual families establishing sporting camps in that region. And in fact, very much taking off on the same kind of sporting impetus for the woods that the Adirondacks were at the same time in northern New York State.
Okay, you've mapped out so much of what we want to talk about more in depth a little later, but I wanted to get to Libby to talk about some of the leading figures that surfaced from that time out of the Civil War. And Oliver Otis Howard was one of them. Tell us, Libby, about his background and what he went on to do.
Sure. I think as we look back on Maine's history in this bicentennial year, it's important to highlight different people and to ask new questions of Maine's history and maybe to inform Mainers a little bit about people they may or may not know about. Of course, learning about Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain as a birthright in Maine, I think, certainly in teaching Maine history, I've found that over the years. But Oliver Otis Howard was actually born in Leeds, Maine. He was a Union general in the Civil War. He's a North Yarmouth Academy and a Bowdoin College graduate, actually. And he then went on to West Point. But he becomes most famous in the years after the Civil War because he is put in charge of the Freedmen's Bureau. The Freedmen's Bureau is essentially the arm responsible for integrating formerly enslaved men, women, children, and families into post-Civil War life during Reconstruction. And so it's marriages, it's finding family members, it's eventually registering to vote, it's housing, it's education. And he is in charge of the Freedmen's Bureau from 1865 to 1874 as its commissioner. He was a pretty staunch evangelical, and he would have been considered in league with the radical Republicans at the time, pushing their agenda in Congress against what President Johnson was thinking in terms of the rights of black men, women, and children following the Civil War in the South and elsewhere. He's also the founder of Howard University in Washington, D.C., and served as its president from 1867 to 1873. His papers are actually at Bowdoin. I think there's a lot more work to be done. He, like many people, is an exceedingly complex figure in history, but he's certainly someone who stands out to me in the post-war, the post-Civil War world is important to linking back to Maine.
And really being on the national stage as well.
Absolutely.
Right.
And really setting so much policy.
Right. And Earl, Howard was one of those who had that level of influence nationally. There are others whose names many of us actually have heard of as well. Tell us about some of the highlights. James Blaine.
I think the two really towering figures of the post-Civil War period from Maine are James G. Blaine and Thomas B. Reed, as far as politicians are concerned. James G. Blaine was born in Pennsylvania. He married a woman from Augusta, Maine, and in 1853, this brought him back to Augusta, where he was the editor for a few years of the Kennebec Journal. And then in 1858, he gets into politics. He runs as a local representative from Augusta. He's really a charismatic figure. He very quickly takes a rise. He becomes Speaker of the House of Representatives in the state legislature within a year, and then uses that as a springboard in 1862 to get elected to the U.S. Congress from Maine. And by 1869, he's Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, position he holds until 1876, a highly influential position. And then he becomes a U.S. senator briefly. And then he tries in 1876 and again in 1880 to get the Republican nomination for president. He fails at that, but he has a good friend in the new president, James A. Garfield, who appoints him Secretary of State. He continues on after Garfield's death with President Arthur briefly. And then in 1884, he captures the prize that he's been after for so many years, the Republican nomination for president. And ironically, he loses by about 5,000 votes to Grover Cleveland. But his career is by no means over. Benjamin Harrison is elected president in 1888, and Blaine finishes out his career as Secretary of State under his third president. And there he really shines because he's very involved in international relations, particularly in Central and South America. And his work as Secretary of State in that period is considered a very important contribution in American history. The other figure, born in 1839 in Portland, is Thomas B. Reed. He's an 1860 graduate of Bowdoin. He rises again, like Blaine, through the political system in Maine, gets into the House of Representatives in Washington in the 1870s, and by around 1890, he's chosen as Speaker of the House. And during the 1890s, he's one of the most powerful figures in America. He does major reforms to the way the House does its business in what are called Reed's Rules. And in fact, some of Reed's rules are still in effect more than a century later. Oh. He attempts to get the nomination for president in 1896, fails to William McKinley. And then a few years later, he resigns from the speakership on principle. He does not believe in America expanding its territories beyond its original borders. He doesn't like the idea of our acquiring territories in the Pacific. And so he resigns, and then he dies in 1902. But both of those men are probably preeminent political figures, not only in Maine, but in the nation in the post-Civil War period.
Okay, great. And I'm just going to go ahead to an email just because it's about the Civil War. So before we get too far farther than that. So it's an email from James, and he says, I've read that Maine sent a greater number of soldiers to fight for the Union on a per capita basis than many other states. Why did so many from the Pine Tree State volunteer?
Well, it's an interesting question and a good one. One of the projects that I've been involved in as state historian, and it parallels a project that Libby has done, I visited as many Civil War monuments as I could all over the state. It ends up that there are an astounding number, about 170, all the way from Kittery up to Ashland. And engraved on so many of those granite monuments are that the men from those individual communities went because they wanted to preserve the Union. There was a very strong feeling in Maine and across the North that the Union that had come out of the Revolution and then was formed by the Constitution in the 1780s was a sacred compact, and that it needed to be preserved. It should not be broken up. And I think that while there were a number of other factors, there was certainly a lot of sentiment against slavery and the ending of slavery, but predominantly the sentiment on those monuments that come down to us today is the preservation of the Union.
Libby, did you want to add to that just in terms of sort of, was Maine known for a particular character already at that time that contributed to this?
I think in terms of, you know, Maine has a reputation certainly of hard work and sacrifice. I know for many men and women who served during the Civil War in Maine, I would also characterize certainly the men who went off to war, but also the women who were on the home front contributing bandages and socks and all sorts of materials to the sanitary commissions, raising money to send to the troops, serving as nurses on the battlefield. I think there's a tremendous legacy of service and dedication to community and dedication to one's neighbors. And also for a lot of immigrants who had come into Maine, particularly Irish immigrants during the famine period in the 1840s, this is not just true in Maine, but it's true in Massachusetts and elsewhere, that the Civil War also became a proving ground for citizenship in the sense of different immigrant groups presenting their fighting in the Civil War as their allegiance to their new country. You see this in World War I as well and in various states across the United States. So I think that's part of the character and the dedication to community. Certainly there's a strong abolition movement in Maine with anti-slavery societies in Hallowell, in Portland, throughout the state itself. Major speakers coming here, Frederick Douglass, William Lloyd Garrison, Sojourner Truth, and others spending time in Maine. And you can't forget Harriet Beecher Stowe in Brunswick writing Uncle Tom's Cabin at the time period, too. So I think, like Earl said, those sentiments, there's no one reason or one explanation that you can point to, but certainly they all factor in.
Okay, well, thank you. We're going to take a quick break right now. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the University of Maine at Augusta, committed to providing a quality, affordable education online and in the classroom. UMA.edu. Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm, and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial. DeadRiver.com. And Modern Pest Services, offering a non-toxic approach to pest control with anti-CMEX smart pest control technology. modernpest.com.
The class of 2020 may be graduating virtually, but they are not skipping out on traditions like the valedictorian and salutatorian speeches.
Life is like a fistful of Sour Patch Kids. Right now, things are sour, but eventually, they will turn sweet.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Humorous and heartfelt messages from this year's high school graduates this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up later this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. As Maine stands together to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic, Maine Public continues to celebrate the first 200 years of Maine's statehood. We're sharing historical information, interesting facts, and personal recollections, both by looking back at how this great state of Maine developed and also peering ahead for the next 200 years. All of our radio and television bicentennial programming can be found again, or for the first time, at mainepublic.org. The Maine State Bicentennial Hub link is under the radio, television, or education drop-downs. You can also find links at mainepublic.org to our bicentennial partners, including the Maine State Archives, the Maine Historical Society, and the Maine State Bicentennial Commission.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today we are continuing our series of programs on Maine history. We're talking about the period from the Civil War through World War I and what was happening in Maine during that time. My guests are Earl Shuttleworth, he's the Maine State Historian, and Libby Bischoff, History Professor with the University of Southern Maine and Executive Director of the Osher Map Library. As always, we want to hear from you. You can email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Maine Calling Facebook page. Right now, our phones seem to be a bit glitchy, so those are the best options, email, Facebook, or tweet. If it's back up and running later, just for the record, our number is 800-399-3566. And Libby, you just mentioned the wave of immigration that began to sort of change the makeup of Maine. And they were coming from Canada and then further away. Can you describe what sort of waves of populations came here and why they came?
Sure. The mid to late 19th and early 20th century is a time of significant immigration into Maine. Some of the industries Earl described at the beginning of the program certainly led to a greater movement of immigrants to come and work in the textile mills. Also, the granite industry is a pretty significant industry in late 19th and early 20th century Maine. And so you have a lot of Italian laborers, Swedish, Finns, and others who are coming in to work at the granite quarries in Vinyl Haven, in Hallowell, and around the state. And certainly you have a tremendous amount of French-Canadian men, women, and children coming across the border from Canada into Maine, drawn by promises of work at mills in Brunswick, in Waterville, and then certainly in Lewiston, Auburn. And I think one of the interesting things you get with the massive immigration that you see in this period is you also get the immigrants coming into these communities and really changing the shape of the communities, certainly with their religious ties in Lewiston and Auburn, building new cathedrals, starting new newspapers like Le Messager, which is a really important newspaper for the Franco population that's founded in 1880 in Lewiston. And you also get the state of Maine looking for immigrants in the 19th century, like sending representatives like William Woodgery Thomas over to Sweden in the 1870s to convince Swedish people to move to central Maine to farm, which was what found New Sweden. So there's a lot of reasons that people are coming to Maine, but they're largely drawn here by promises of work.
Okay, and around that time, electricity came into use in Maine with the mills and other in other ways, it changed Maine. Is that right, Earl? That was sort of a turning point.
Yes. Well, you have Thomas Edison and others in the 1870s beginning to make great advances. The light bulb, for example, is invented by Edison in 1879. And very quickly thereafter, the light bulb, the telephone, things that would use electricity begin to get spread into Maine. And one of the very important developments as an offset of things that require electricity is the development of our hydropower. Now, of course, we'd used hydropower since the 17th century to run our mills and our sawmills, but now it became a very important factor in generating electricity. One of the interesting developments of this period is that many smaller communities saw the development of individual hydro companies, very local companies that would supply electricity beginning in the 1880s and 90s. But then around the turn of the century, you have Walter Wyman and Harvey Doan Eaton from Waterville having this concept of amalgamating these companies into what becomes in the early 20th century the Central Maine Power Company. And so from many of these small hydro operations, you get the one large one that we have today.
Great. Well, we now have a call coming in from Fred from Arousic, and I'm hoping our phones work. So, Fred, hi, thanks for calling. What was your question?
Hi, great program. I just wanted to ask Earl Shuttleworth if he'd talk a little bit about Arthur Sewell, the Bath shipbuilder of quite considerable fame, both locally and nationally, and interestingly, why and how he was chosen by Williams Jennings Bryan as a running mate.
I'm very happy to comment on that. Arthur Sewell was from a very prominent shipbuilding family in Bath. In 1896, there was the Democratic Convention, and William Jennings Bryan, who was a young senator, a very charismatic figure, he gave a famous speech at the convention talking about that mankind will not be crucified on a cross of gold. He was for silver rather than gold as our monetary exchange. And as very much like the Lincoln-Hamlin connection of the election of 1860, there was a need for a geographic balance. And so we have Bryan, who came from Nebraska, needing a running mate, a Democrat from the Northeast, and Arthur Sewell got chosen. And they both campaigned very hard, but lost to McKinley and Garrett Hobart. The Maine State Museum has a marvelous large scrapbook that was kept by Sewell's family during the election. And there's every imaginable newspaper clipping, piece of campaign memorabilia, and whatever that documents that campaign of 1896.
Okay, great. Thank you, Earl. And I know that both of you were interested in talking about how around this time, tourism, which you mentioned earlier, Earl, tourism actually came into play in Maine's economy. It was actually quite vital even back then as it is now. So how did that come about and how did it sort of help our overall economy?
Well, people began to discover the natural beauty of Maine, both the coast and inland, prior to the Civil War. One of the things that popularized Maine in the larger cities, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, were these beautiful Hudson River School paintings that were done by painters like Thomas Cole and Frederick Church. And so people would go to these art exhibits and they'd see Mount Desert Island, they'd see Mount Katahdin and so on. And as a result, they became fascinated. Well, you know, what is this place in the Northeast? And at the same time, just beginning before the Civil War, but really developing much more after the war, were these new forms of rapid, easy public transportation, the steamship network and the railroad network. And the railroads and the steamships really popularize the idea of the ease of travel to the coast of Maine and to the inland regions. It also comes at a time when there's an emerging middle and upper class with the means to be able for the first time to take vacations, to take time off, and to travel. And so Maine becomes an important summer destination. Also, people want to, if they can, escape the hot and disease-ridden cities, and Maine is popularized as a very healthful place to go. So as a result, you have these great summer hotels that develop. One of the most famous is the Poland Spring House in Poland, and then along the coast, the Samoset inland on Moosehead Lake, the Mount Kineo House. But there were many of these great hotels. And then, of course, the spinoff were the cottage colonies, particularly along the coast and the lakes.
I heard there was a term called the rusticators for people who come from the cities to enjoy the fresh air and nature.
Yes, that was a very popular term. It was used particularly for people on the coast and especially in the Mount Desert region.
And Libby, Earl just mentioned the role that transportation played. That's something that I know you look at through your research. It was pretty critical to helping the tourist industry and also supporting growth during the later 1800s.
Absolutely. And you see the tourist industry, places like, and especially with transportation, companies like the Boston and Maine Railroad invest heavily into advertising. So they're making these very lush booklets, maps, scenic books that people can pick up and plan their trips to really attract people here. And when you see trains then kind of transition somewhat into trolleys for the interurban transportation between cities and towns all over New England, you'll find also that the trolley companies in the early 20th century invest heavily in trolley parks. So places like the Cape Cottage Casino, there is the castle in South Freeport, that there the trolleys companies actually create these destinations for people to come and play at, to watch lacrosse games, to play golf, to rent a boat to paddle around on the river, to play croquet on the lawn, and really capitalizing on even getting local people to take their Saturday or a Sunday and go there. And I think with this push for tourism in Maine comes, in many ways, the creation of the myth of Maine that still challenges Maine's present life, I think, as well, that Maine is this place out of time, different from the rest of the country, where you could go and experience the way life used to be in kind of a pre-modern way, and to get away from all your troubles, which sometimes overlooks how hard life really can be here, how on the edge so many Maine people are in terms of poverty. And that was true in the 19th and early 20th century as it is now. Vacation land has many benefits, but also many detractions for people who live here year-round.
Yeah, so interesting, because it's also playing into this whole pandemic response of the Maine brand attracting people from elsewhere, but not necessarily for the right reasons. So why don't we go now to a call that came in earlier today from Andrea. This is a voicemail she left us.
This is Andrea from Jonesboro, Maine. I just heard today that you are going to be discussing the history of Maine from 1860 to World War I, and I wanted to tell your listeners about a great book called A Day's Work, A Sampler of Historic Maine Photographs, 1860 to 1920. There are two volumes that have the most incredible photos from all the various Maine industries between 1860 and 1920, as well as nonfiction stories to accompany them. It was compiled and annotated by W.H. Bunting. The photos of schooner racing, logging, building, horsework, human work are just outstanding. It's an historical treasure box of information about the history of Maine, and nobody would be disappointed if they purchase it. It's published by Tilbury House Publishers in Portland, Maine. Okay, I'll listen to the show today. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Great. Earl or Libby, do you know of that work?
Yeah, I'm very familiar with it. The author, Bill Bunting, who lives in Whitefield, is a close personal friend, and he is really one of our outstanding historians in Maine, particularly in his ability to gather significant and telling historical photographs, and then the way in which he very creatively and intelligently interprets them for the reader. It's a brilliant piece of work, and everything that was described by the caller is more than true.
Okay, great.
Andrea may be happy to know that I'm sitting in my office and I can see those two volumes on my shelf. As a photo historian, Earl and I and our colleagues in Danley wrote History of Photography in Maine a few years back, and photos of labor are central to telling Maine's history. You cannot understand Maine's history without looking at the history of work and labor. So excellent recommendation.
Great. And there's, speaking of historic images of Maine, the Bird's Eye View exhibit, does one of you want to mention that?
Yes, I think both Libby and I wanted to comment on that briefly. Back earlier in the year, I think on one of our previous calls, I had mentioned about an exhibit that was at Bowdoin on called Maine's Lithographic Landscapes. That exhibit covered the period from 1820 to 1860 with the large panoramic prints of Maine towns and cities of that period. After the Civil War, the technique shifted from these large artistic panoramic views to these more precise map-like views of Maine towns and cities, and there was a much greater proliferation of them. Between about 1875 and 1900, I've been working very closely with Libby and the OSHA Map Library on this, we've ascertained that there were about 90 Maine communities that had these bird's eye view maps made. And they are today, in retrospect, an incredible record of what each of these communities was like in the post-Civil War period. Libby may want to add to that.
Certainly, only to say that we are working under a bicentennial grant. We got to digitize these maps at the OSHA Map Library. Maine Historic Preservation Commission versions at Maine Historical Society, and the digitized maps as well as commentary will be up in a few months on our website, oshermaps.org. So it'll be a great way to get really into the local nature of this period in Maine history with these bird's eye views. And when you digitize these maps in such high resolution like we do at 100 megapixels, you can zoom right into the people walking the streets. It's really amazing to be able to see at the house level and the human level what these Maine towns looked like.
That's fascinating. And we'll make sure to put that, is it oshermaps.org, on our Maine Calling website. And we're just going to take another quick break right now. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Maine Office of Tourism, encouraging you to get back out there and gain a whole new appreciation for Maine by returning to favorite spots and discovering new ones and exploring everything that makes Maine uniquely Maine. The jagged mountains and rolling rivers are calling. The secluded trails and abundant forests are calling, just like they have been for over two centuries. Revisit and reconnect with the places Mainers call home. For inspiration and itineraries, go to visitmaine.com. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
The first naval battle of the American Revolution took place in Machias Harbor on June 11th and 12th, 1775. A merchant ship, the Unity, was commandeered by the townspeople and, led by Benjamin Foster and Jeremiah O'Brien, rammed the British warship, the Margarita. The British vessel had traveled to Maine to ensure that a load of lumber would be delivered for the British Army's barracks in Boston. Although armed with only axes, pitchforks, hunting rifles, and shovels, the Machias Patriots successfully stormed aboard and captured the ship.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of DN Wealth Advisors and the Maine Seacoast Mission. Happy birthday, Maine.
Welcome to Maine Public's This Is My Maine.
I often get asked as why I chose to live in Maine, and I'd say that as the great-grandson of L.L. Bean and having worked in the family business for nearly 30 years, You could argue that the decision was made for me, but in reality, Maine is a terrific place to live. Not only is it filled with natural beauty, but the people of Maine are really unique. Mainers are a great combination of quiet resolve, Yankee ingenuity, and terrific work ethic and values. I'm Sean from L.L. Bean, and this is My Maine.
This is My Maine is brought to you through the support of Eaton Peabody, the Maine Community Foundation, and the generous support of members like you. Thank you. Go to MainePublic.org to experience more of Maine Public's celebration of Maine's first 200 years. Happy birthday, Maine.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. We're learning about Maine's period of growth from the Civil War through World War I and what it meant for the state's future. Joining me, Libby Bischoff, professor of history with USM, and Earl Shuttleworth, our Maine state historian. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Maine Calling Facebook page. And just earlier, Libby, we were talking about tourism and the major role it played at that time. Old Orchard Beach, I guess, in those days was a major tourist hotspot. And there was a special place there, the Cummins Guest House. Can you talk about that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. As we think about tourism and accessibility and who can come here in different aspects of Maine history, as we know, the study of race and racism is not unique to our 21st century issues. And so there were a lot of alternative sites and guest houses that developed in Maine to serve different populations. One of them was Mrs. Cummings' Guest House in Old Orchard Beach, who served Black men, women, and their families who were traveling up to the area. They are listed in the infamous Green Book, as well as on other maps that are put out by African American travel groups as places that they would find to be very welcoming to members of the Black community. We have the guest books as part of the African American collection in USM's Sampson Center for Diversity and University Special Collections. And it's really amazing to look through the guest house registers, which are digitized. And Cindy, I can give you a link to put that up. But you can see people like Duke Ellington and his wife coming in and staying as he's playing shows. And so I think it's important to highlight those spaces, too, in the same way that you see that in some communities in southern Maine at this time, for Jewish travelers, there was often a lot of anti-Semitism that prohibited them from going to certain hotels and resorts, certain golf clubs, certain boating clubs. And so you see other opportunities evolve around summer camps as well in Maine, serving particular communities.
Okay, we'll go to a call now. Kitsy is calling from Portland. Hi, Kitsy. What did you want to talk about?
Hi. I wanted to talk about the fact that so far I haven't heard anything about the people who were here before 1820, the indigenous people, the tribes of Maine. And certainly I think they need to figure in, even though they're not celebrating this particular Eurocentric history of Maine. So I just would like some comments on that.
Sure. We have talked about the populations that were here in the earlier time in Maine, but as far as this period of time in the later 1800s and early 1900s, Earl, what was happening with the indigenous people here?
Well, primarily you have the two major communities. You have the Penobscots at Old Town and the Passamaquoddies at Pleasant Point near Eastport. In a tradition that had really begun before the Civil War, but now accelerated after the Civil War and into the 20th century, very much related to summer tourism, both of the Native American tribes played an important role, particularly in going to the coast, but also up inland to Moosehead Lake, to the Mount Kineo House, to sell their beautiful crafts. This is a period when the basket making begins to flourish and becomes very, very popular as part of Maine's artwork and Maine's culture. That I think you find a very strong Native American presence in the summer communities along the coast, even to the extent where initially a number of Native Americans establish their tents along the waterfront in Bar Harbor, and then a little bit later they're actually given a section of Bar Harbor to reside in during the summer and sell their wares.
Okay, thanks
if
for
I
your...
Sure,
Libby, go ahead.
If I respond to Kitsy, and I really appreciate the comment, certainly something I talk about a lot in teaching Maine history, that certainly with the bicentennial, that's only 200 years of statehood, whereas Maine's history stretches back more than 12,000 years. And I think in terms of looking at this particular period and talking about immigration and things like that, Maine Historical ran a really important exhibit a few years ago called 400 Years of New Mainers. And I think in thinking about the bicentennial, I think it's really important to say that if you were not indigenous to this place, right, that you are, in fact, a New Mainer as well. And I think thinking with that perspective is important. In the 19th century, certainly as Earl said, a lot of tribes turn to promoting the craft and the basketry as a way to make money, but that's often because so many other avenues of revenue and jobs were often closed to them. This is a period in the United States history where the government was pursuing forced assimilation against Native American tribes around the country. And Maine is not immune to that. I think something that people would be interesting to know that after the Carlisle Indian School was established in 1876, we often think of tribes that have been forced to Oklahoma and from the West, that those children are the only ones being sent to Indian schools. But in fact, children from Penobscot and the Passamaquoddy tribes were also taken and forced to assimilate in these Indian schools as well. And so I think these are things that are really important to think about and address as we address the bicentennial.
Okay. Thanks so much for your call, Kitsy. We have an email from Lonnie. It says, I'm wondering if anyone could address how it is that the Confederate flag currently is representing some odd sort of patriotism and white historical context. What can we gather from this?
Libby?
Well, the best news I heard about the Confederate flag yesterday was that that NASCAR banned
right.
it from all of their I think that people turn, and you see this in Maine and you see this in elsewhere, that there is this argument about the Confederate flag that certain people have put forward, that it means heritage and not hate. But I think in 2020 that it's pretty clear that for so many people, it rightly represents an image of hate, which is why you see it being taken down in so many places.
Right. And a somewhat related note from Anne, please discuss what happened on Malaga Island in 1912. Libby, this does tie to the tourism you were talking about. If you could briefly talk about that so we can get to World War One before the end of the show.
Yeah.
Sure, I'd be happy to. And I think it's tied into World War One as well. So as many people know, this the story of Malaga Island was a hidden part of Maine's history for years, considered a more shameful aspect to be hidden in the past. But I think what commemoration should do is to uncover all of Maine's history and shine light on it. And so in 1912, in July 1st, 1912, under Governor Plaisted, the state of Maine purchased Malaga Island, and residents were told that they had to forcefully evacuate the island. As many of you know, the Malaga Island community was a mixed-race population, mostly of fishermen, of people who lived together. They had their own school. They had their own industry. But in terms of the tourism developing in Fitchburg and elsewhere, that for many, Malaga Island, which you can see, you can almost at low tide walk over from Fitchburg, was considered a blight and that would turn away tourists. And so Maine has this pretty central moment of eugenics and racism where they not only evacuate the mixed race community, but they then send many of the residents to Pineland And they go so far as to dig up the dead of the community on the island and bury them at Pineland, which was then called the Maine School for the Feeble-Minded. So I would encourage listeners, if you haven't been to the cemetery at Pineland, if you haven't been to Malaga, you should go to Malaga. But if you haven't been to the cemetery at Pineland, there's a series of really beautiful monuments and memorials to the people of Malaga Island to keep telling the story. And there's a lot available online that people can learn more.
Okay, thanks, Libby. And we're just going to, we did say we're going to talk about World War I on this show. So Earl, I just want to, if we can kind of briefly talk about what was Maine's involvement in the war?
Well, first, just for comparison, I think I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but with the Civil War, you have to bear in mind that it was 4 years in duration, from April of 1861 to April of 1865, and that Maine contributed more than 70,000 troops. World War I, as far as America is concerned, was declared in April of 1917. We entered the European War at that time, and it was over in November of 1918. So it's about 19 months in duration. In that period, about 35,000 Maine men and women became involved in the war. There was a tremendous outpouring of support in Maine for the war, particularly on the home front. There were literally millions upon millions of dollars bought in bonds. There was a system of helping to finance the war by buying U.S. war bonds. Maine definitely made its significant contribution on the battlefield in Europe as well.
And Libby, I understand there are some World War I monuments here in Maine. How can people learn more about those quickly?
There are many to commemorate the centennial of World War I, which was really started in 2014 into 2018, and with the armistice and beyond in 2019, my students and I created the Maine World War I Memorial Project, which you can just Google. And we went all over the state tracking down memorials, much like Earl did with the Civil War, and really finding the personal stories of these monuments and memorials in communities all over the state. World War I is often considered America's forgotten war. It definitely gets overshadowed by both World War II and the Civil War. And I think what you will find is that Maine communities paid honor to these sacrifices, as did the state of Maine. Next time listeners drive over from Portsmouth into Kittery, if you go over the new Memorial Bridge, which was actually the Memorial Bridge was for World War I soldiers, take a look at the state of Maine's World War I memorial on the Kittery side. It was controversial at the time. It was made by a Russian Jewish sculptor from Boston, Bashka Paev. And it is a mother holding a child. It's called The Sacrifices of War. And it's really a monument to peace. It's very anti-war in many ways, which was very controversial at the time. So I think it's an interesting moment for Maine to take this stand against global war in that way. And it's worth taking a look if you've never seen it.
Okay, great. Well, thank you both. We will pick up on this with our next Maine History Show. Earl Shuttleworth and Libby Bischoff. Earl is the longtime state historian for Maine, and Libby Bischoff is a history professor with the University of Southern Maine. Lucy Suchek ran the board today, and today's Maine Calling program will be rebroadcast at 7. Stay tuned for today's CDC briefing with Director Nirav Shah. You can also watch it on Maine Public Television and on our website. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.